Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We're up to Book 13, Chapter 10, and by skimming ahead just quickly, we are still not back with our main characters. Sigh. Goes a little bit like this. But, strange to say, all these measures, efforts and plans, which were not at all worse than others issued in similar circumstances, did not affect the essence of the matter, but like the hands of a clock detached from the mechanism swung about in an arbitrary and aimless way without engaging the cogwheels. With reference to the military side, the plan of campaign, that work of genius of which theirs remarks that his genius never devised anything more profound, more skilful, or more admirable, and enters into a polemic with M. Fain to prove that this work of genius must be referred to, not to the 4th, but to the 15th of October. That plan never was or could be executed, for it was quite out of touch with the facts of the case. The fortifying of the Kremlin, for which La Mosque, as Napoleon termed the church of Basil the Beautified, was to have been razed to the ground, proved quite useless. The mining of the Kremlin only helped towards fulfilling Napoleon's wish that it should be blown up when he left Moscow, as a child wants the floor on which he has hurt himself to be beaten. The pursuit of the Russian army, about which Napoleon was so concerned, produced an unheard-of result. The French generals lost touch with the Russian army of 60,000 men, and according to theirs, it was only eventually found, like a lost pin, by the skill and apparently the genius of Murat. With reference to diplomacy, all Napoleon's arguments as to his magnanimity and justice, both to Chutilomin and to Yakovlev, whose chief concern was to obtain a great coat and a conveyance, proved useless. Alexander did not receive these envoys and did not reply to their embassage. With regard to legal matters, after the execution of the supposed incendiaries, the rest of Moscow burnt down. With regard to administrative matters, the establishment of a municipality did not stop the robberies and was only of use to certain people who formed part of that municipality and, under pretext of preserving order, looted Moscow or saved their own property from being looted. With regard to religion, as to which in Egypt matters had so easily been settled by Napoleon's visit to a mosque, no results were achieved. Two or three priests who were found in Moscow did try to carry out Napoleon's wish, but one of them was slapped in the face by a French soldier while conducting service, and a French official reported of another that the priest whom I found and invited to mass cleaned and locked up the church. That night the doors were again broken open, the padlocks smashed, the books mutilated, and other disorders perpetrated. With reference to commerce, the proclamation to industrious workmen and to peasants evoked no response. There were no industrious workmen, and the peasants caught the commissionaries who ventured too far out of town with the proclamation and killed them. As to the theatres for the entertainment of the people and the troops, these did not meet with success either. The theatres set up in the Kremlin and in Poznanskov's house were closed again at once because the actors and actresses were robbed. Even philanthropy did not have the desired effect. The genuine, as well as the false paper money which flooded Moscow, lost its value. The French, collecting booty, cared only for gold. Not only was the paper money which Napoleon so graciously distributed to the unfortunate valueless, but even silver lost its value in relation to gold. But the most amazing example of the ineffectiveness of the orders given by the authorities at that time was Napoleon's attempt to stop the looting and re-establish discipline. This is what the army authorities were reporting. Looting continues in the city, despite the decrees against it. Order is not yet restored, and not a single merchant is carrying on trade in a lawful manner. The sutlers alone venture to trade, and they sell stolen goods. The neighbourhood of my ward continues to be pillaged by soldiers of the Third Corps, who, not satisfied with taking from the unfortunate inhabitants hiding in the cellars the little they have left, even have the ferocity to wound them with their sabres, as I have repeatedly witnessed. Nothing new except that the soldiers are robbing and pillaging. 9th of October. Robbery and pillaging continue. There is a band of thieves in our district who ought to be arrested by a strong force. 11th of October. The Emperor is extremely displeased that despite the strict orders to stop pillage, parties of marauding guards are continually seen returning to the Kremlin. Among the old guard, disorder and pillage were renewed more violently than ever yesterday evening, last night, and today. The Emperor sees with regret that the picked soldiers appointed to guard his person, who should set an example of discipline, early disobedience to such a point that they break into the cellars and stores containing army supplies. Others have graced themselves to the extent of disobeying sentinels and officers and have abused and beaten them. The Grand Marshal of the place, wrote the governor, complains bitterly that in spite of repeated orders, the soldiers continue to commit nuisances in all the courtyards and even under the very windows of the Emperor. That army, like a herd of cattle, run wild and trampling underfoot, the provender which might have saved it from starvation, disintegrated and perished with each additional day it remained in Moscow, but it did not go away. It began to run away only when suddenly seized by a panic caused by the capture of transport trains on the Smolensk Road and by the Battle of Tarutino. The news of that Battle of Tarutino, unexpectedly received by Napoleon at a review, evoked in him a desire to push the Russians, theirs, says, and he issued the order for departure which the whole army was demanding. Fleeing from Moscow, the soldiers took with them everything they had stolen. Napoleon, too, carried away his own personal trésor. But on seeing the baggage trains that impeded the army, he was, theirs say, horror-struck. And yet, with his experience of war, he did not order all the superfluous vehicles to be burnt, as he had done with those of certain marshal when approaching Moscow. He gazed at the calèches and the carriages in which soldiers were riding and remarked that it was a very good thing, as these vehicles could be used to carry provisions, the sick and the wounded. The plight of the whole army resembled that of a wounded animal which feels it is perishing and does not know what it is doing. To study the skilful tactics and aims of Napoleon and his army from the time it entered Moscow till it was destroyed is like studying the dying leaps and shudders of a mortally wounded animal. Very often a wounded animal, hearing a rustle, rushes straight at the hunter's gun, runs forward and back again, and hastens its own end. Napoleon, under pressure from his whole army, did the same thing. The rustle of the Battle of Tarutino frightened the beast, and it rushed forward onto the hunter's gun, reached him, turned back, and finally, like any wild beast, ran back along the most disadvantageous and dangerous path where the old scent was familiar. During the whole of that period, Napoleon, who seems to us to have been the leader of all those movements, as the figurehead of a ship may seem to a savage to guide the vessel, acted like a child who, holding a couple of strings inside a carriage, thinks he is driving it. All right, there we go, another chapter down, another day without our main characters. I did take the liberty of having a look at the first sentence or so of the next chapter, and can happily report that the word Pierre was in there. So, it looks like, as of tomorrow, I should say, the wait is over, and we'll be back with our characters. Ah, how good. How good is a book with characters? So good. So, what happened here? Napoleon's big old plan, and all his promises to the people have fallen apart. Everything's gone, completely the opposite of what he intended. No one's playing ball. No one's worshipping him the way he hoped would happen, I suppose, in his fancy. That's what he thought was going to happen, right? He'd be the new king. Everyone would accept him and love him. But no. More looting. More violence. It got worse and worse. Turtle Vader said, "The proclamations have almost no effect on the start of Moscow. In fact, in some cases, they worsen the chaos. Why is this?" Why is this? That's a good question. I think it was to do with the impatience shown by Napoleon. He's trying to push too quickly for these things to happen. That would be my take on it. The interesting thing about this chapter was that they didn't leave Moscow. They weren't sort of fleeing from the place in defeat. It was actually that Napoleon was so disappointed and angry that nothing worked out, that it was almost like a knee-jerk reaction, almost like an emotional reaction, that nothing's working out, let's go and attack them. And so they've launched into this pursuit. It's a withdrawal from Moscow, but it's in pursuit of the Russian army, which is not a good idea, because they've rushed into it. They're not in a strong position. Their army isn't strong. It's an emotional move, and the kind of contrast here between Kutuzov and Napoleon is pretty stark, right? Because we've always seen Kutuzov as this patient guy who just waits it out, who just does nothing. That's his big move, isn't it, to do nothing and just wait to see what happens. And it kind of, as he waits and does nothing, things just sort of happen on their own accord, and he just keeps an eye on it and very, very strictly picks his battles, doesn't he? He takes all the emotion out of his decisions, is what I'd say. Whereas this decision by Napoleon seems almost entirely emotional. And you got to sort of think at this point, don't you, that maybe Tolstoy is being a bit biased, because Napoleon was a great leader. There's no two ways about it. He did great things all around the world. And he was defeated in Russia. But it's almost like they're trying to say that he was defeated just because, you know, he never was a good leader, and he just got lucky over and over again, and then the Russians came and just kind of swatted him away, and it was no big problem. And it was actually more his own fault. It was like unforced errors. You know, they just waited until he made mistakes and capitalized on them. But I don't think, really. I mean, sure, he made mistakes, but it wasn't all just hubris and emotional reactions. It was probably more circumstantial than that. Although, you know, what do I know? Nothing. This is all happening 200 years ago for me, whereas for Tolstoy it was 50 odd years ago. So, hey. I think my point is, it's almost too, there's no benefit of the doubt at all extended Napoleon's way, and it's too adamant that he was emotional and making silly decisions and incapable or even incompetent is what it's implied that he is, isn't it? Alright, that's going to do us for today's chapter. Thank you very much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.